talk to me, so you can see.
Peace Talks, a forum for peacemaking and nonviolent conflict resolution within ourselves, our families, our neighborhoods, our country, our world. Martin Luther King said, "I refuse to accept the view that mankind is so tragically bound to the starless midnight of racism and war that the bright daybreak of peace and brotherhood can never become reality. I believe that unarmed truth and unconditional love will have the final word." Today on Peace Talks, Peaceful Race Relations, an African-American Perspective.
I'm Suzanne Kreider. History is filled with examples of conflict between races. This is the first in a series of Peace Talks shows that will explore efforts to resolve that conflict from different racial perspectives. Today, an African-American perspective. Our guests are three people who are African-American, each born and raised in different generations and in different parts of New Mexico in the United States. We'll ask them to reflect on their greatest challenges and successes in resolving racial conflict throughout their lives. And we hope to identify some specific steps that members of all races can take to make peace with each other. Our guests are Tanya Covington, Racial Justice Coordinator for the YWCA of the Middle Rio Grande, James Lewis, Chief Operating Officer for the City of Albuquerque, and Otiamba Umi, a student at the University of New Mexico. Welcome to all of you.
Hello. Hello.
Welcome.
Well, let's get started. You all have been willing to share some of your own personal histories. And James, I want to start with you. You were born in 1947 in Roswell. And I'd like for you to just tell us a story, and if you could, maybe your first memory of when you realized that because of the color of your skin, the rules were different.
Well, one of the things that was really shocking to me to a certain extent, being born in Roswell, New Mexico, the schools were segregated when I started elementary school. So all of my instructors were black. That was first grade. When I started second grade, we moved from Roswell to Albuquerque. The schools were integrated. So it was a culture shock for me to come to a school where all my teachers were black, now they're all white. I did not see another African-American teacher that I had until the seventh grade. Mrs. Manning, I can remember her very vividly today. She was a math teacher. The second instructor that I had was Mrs. Jones. She was a math teacher in the eighth grade. And those were the only two African-American teachers that I had throughout the public school system here in New Mexico. And it was a rude awakening. And then when I graduated from high school in Gallup, New Mexico, I went to a historical black school, Bishop College in Dallas, Texas. So that was another culture shock for me, being African-American. I had never been really involved with the African-American community per se.
So what did that feel like to jump from different school and from going to a segregated school to a desegregated school?
It was a real eye-opener for me, and I didn't understand why. We didn't have the same instructors. You couldn't go to the school that you want to. So years later, I really understand the history of why I could not.
Tanya?
I think it's very interesting for me. I have a pretty vivid memory of noticing a difference much earlier. I was born in Washington, D.C., which is predominantly African American. But my father joined the service, and so when I was 3 years old, we moved to Africa, to North Africa, and were stationed on a military base. I remember when I was about 4 years old, going down the street to play with a little girl who I'd played with many times before, and I knocked on the door and asked her if she could come out and play, and she said no, she couldn't. And my first thought was, uh-oh, she's in some kind of trouble, and she's being punished. And I asked her, and she said no. I said, well, then come on, let's go play. And she said no. She said, I can't play with you. And I said, why? Because we had played together before. And she said, my mother said I can't play with you anymore because you're different. And my mother loves telling the story. What I did was I pulled up my dress and said, what do you mean? I'm a little girl. You're a little girl. What do you mean I'm different? And she said, no, my mother said I can't play with you anymore because you're black. And I didn't have a response for that. It was the first time that someone had ever been that blatant with me, and I was 4 years old. So I remember going home and telling my mother what happened, and you know, she just tried very hard to explain, you know, to my four-year-old mind that there are some people who believe that, and those people are wrong, and that there was nothing wrong with me. But for me as a four-year-old, what stayed with me was that it was for the first time in my life I lost a friend.
And Otiyama, you're the youngest of our guests.
Right,
you're
right.
Born in 1983.
Growing up during my generation, I lived in a black neighborhood predominantly, but yet I went to an all-white school. So I've never really I got that cultural, I guess you could say, background and knowledge through my parents and my grandparents growing up in that neighborhood. So, you know, they would tell me stories as far as my own experiences go. Well, also, see, I'm not only I'm African-American, I'm also Japanese. I'm half Japanese, half African-American. So it kind of puts me in the perspective of that I have a multicultural viewpoint, not solely just African-American, but that allows me to maybe, I guess you could say, take a step away and look at things from both sides, you know. I don't have a specific story, but like growing up through the years going in school, you just noticed that as being the only African-American, you know, according to my skin color anyway, a minority growing up in school, you just noticed that as far as teachers, the way teachers treated students of color and minorities, I don't know, teachers paid certain more attention to students, you know, who were doing good, more predominantly white students than the ones minorities. Also, through sports, as I got a little older, I knew that I was one of the, you know, one of the best athletes on the team and could really perform, and that I wasn't. I assumed that the, you know, the coach was being racist towards, you know, the minority me. that's what I felt personally, because, I mean, it just doesn't seem right that if you have, you know, good players on the team, you're not going to play them.
This is Peace Talks, and we're talking about peaceful race relations with Tanya Covington, Racial Justice Coordinator for the YWCA of the Middle Rio Grande, James Lewis, Chief Operating Officer of the City of Albuquerque, and Otiyama Umi, a student at the University of New Mexico. I want to talk about white privilege. When I was about 8 years old, I remember being in the back seat of my parents' station wagon, and there was a girl sitting next to me. She was one of my sister's friends, and she was the first African-American I ever remember talking to. And we were driving her to her house. I grew up in a little town in the Midwest called Freeport, Illinois, 26,000. I remember literally driving across train tracks to a part of town I'd never seen. I'd never been there. And I remember asking my mom, is this still Freeport? Mm-hmm. There were little tiny houses that I could tell all of a sudden that this was a place I'd never been, and that people who lived here didn't have as much as I had. And I'm curious, what is it that white people need to know and begin to see about white privilege?
I think, first of all, most white people need to admit that it exists and understand what white privilege is. For an awful lot of whites don't believe that it exists and don't believe that they have any privilege in being white. But there are certain things that come to you naturally or come to you easily because of the color of your skin that don't come to us. They've been shown, studies that have shown, and programs that have been done, that if two people walk into a store, one white, one black, the security guard is going to follow the black person, irregardless of whether they do anything wrong or irregardless of what the white person is like. That's a privilege that white people have. Most don't know that they have and take it for granted. And that is perpetuated in all different stratas of life, in employment, in government, and in all different ways throughout this country. And so I think that the main thing is that white people need to know that it exists and understand it before anything can ever be done about it.
James, how about you?
I've had a couple things happen to me that when you talk about white privilege, being elected as the only African-American to be elected statewide in the state of New Mexico, had a chance to go to New York for bond closing. And so we had some bankers to pick us up. My deputy state treasurer was David King, who was white American. And so we were walking in the airport, and they had a car to come pick us up, and they walked to him, assuming he is Mr. Lewis the treasurer, and walked right by me. So, you know, we really don't realize, and I still think about some of those incidents and some of the other official positions that I've served in. People have been very surprised, very shocking to realize once. And studies have shown that when African-Americans, and if you sound black, then it's tough for you to get housing. I had some of my friends here when they came back from the military after we got out of the Vietnam War, living in the South Broadway area, trying to move to the Northeast Heights. It was very difficult.
So do you get really angry about that?
Well, I did, because you go and put your life on the line for this country that you love, and you come back here and you can't find a job. You see a lot of veterans that have mental illness today that are walking the streets, and a lot of them are black, a lot of them are minorities. And all they've asked for, I paid my dues in the military, can I come back and find housing? Can I come back and find a job? And when you talk about white privilege, I think, again, if you look at the percentage, you're not going to see as you know, number-wise, you may see more out there. So just like welfare, you may have a percentage of more minorities on there, but the raw number is you got more white on there. Whenever you hear something in the news, it's always talking about the minority.
So let's talk about successes that you all have had in terms of conflict resolution related to race. Tanya, there was a story that you told me about a situation in high school.
Yes, I went to a small high school, began a small high school in New Mexico, and we ended up at one point coming very close to having a race riot around the fact this was before Martin Luther King. His birthday was a holiday, and we had asked as a black student body whether or not we could go to a service that was honoring him. For some reason, that angered a number of people in the school who passed that on to some people in the town. And what ended up happening was that as a group of students were on their way back to school from the service, a number of young black boys were literally picked up by the police, taken to the police station, and threatened and intimidated with guns. They were then brought back to the school and told to tell the other black students what had happened to them, and that it would happen to all of us if we were to ever get out of line. Of course, it escalated. Things came close to getting out of hand when several of us decided that what we really needed to do was to be able to try and sit down and talk to people. And I was one of the ones who leading in that, and I always feel like that's what set me on the road to doing the work that I do today. But I feel like there are a lot of things that have happened, I think, in all of our lives where we sort of have to make the choice of how we react. I feel very strongly about trying to take a nonviolent stance on things whenever I can, and I feel like I have a wonderful example in Dr. Martin Luther King, and I draw a lot of strength from that.
Anybody else on resolving conflict?
Well, you know, I think one of the things that I've tried to do is lead by example. I was told over and over again that James Lewis, there's no way, and several years ago, and then 20 years ago, I got ready to run for public office. People said, you can't do it because you're African-American. And I said, if we still have a slave mentality with the shackles on our minds, the shackles on our wrists, that's even more reason why I need to run so that our young folks can say, you can be whatever you want to be. If you believe in it, if you dream it, if you want to work hard to make it a reality, then you can do it. So I still believe very strongly that you can lead by example.
You have a pretty strong history in the civil rights movement, and I'm wondering if you can think of a particular example where you really had to make peace between two people or two groups.
I was a vice president of NAACP here, and one of the things that we had to do is dealing with the tri-culture thing. We travel around this state talking to governors, talking, and very few people still use that term because we said, you know, we're here. You can't ignore us. We're here in living color. So I think that's a good example there.
One thing I think it's also very important to remember is that we have a very rich tradition in the African-American community of conflict resolution. Most people don't realize that the very first black man to ever win the Nobel Peace Prize was Dr. Ralph Bunche, who went to school in Albuquerque, New Mexico. He won the Nobel Peace Prize for forging the first ever peace treaty in the Middle East. And years later, when people talk to him about how he became a peacemaker and where he learned his lessons, he actually spoke about the woman who was his teacher here in Albuquerque and felt like a lot of the lessons that he learned from her, he was able to go on and use them in his life. So I think it's very important for us to realize that making peace is something that we know how to do. We've always done it very well, and it's a choice that we make each time we're in a conflict situation.
And Tanya, you do diversity training both in your work for the YWCA and in your own company, Peacemaker Consulting. What kinds of experiences come up in the diversity training, and do you often find resistance in your workshops?
There's always a lot of resistance around any sort of diversity training, mainly because in this country, we don't talk about race. A lot of people are taught that we're not supposed to talk about it. They're uncomfortable talking about it. There's actually even a perception that talking about it will make it worse. And so all of that has to be overcome. What I find is that lots of times people come into the training or the dialogue very, very hesitantly. They don't come out the other side that way. Usually people at the end of it find that there is such a relief of finally being able to talk about the elephant in the living room that we were supposed to pretend wasn't there at all. The other thing that happens so very often is in doing something where we actually have a chance to dialogue, people find out that they have so much more in common than they did different, and they're usually surprised, and that's usually a great comfort to people. They find that they're actually far more able to talk to people from different cultures easily than they thought they would be able to be. And most people find that it's a very enjoyable experience, even though they were very hesitant coming in.
Oh, Tiamo, what's your experience been in diversity training?
I've attended maybe a class or two. Sharing experiences is a little hesitant at times because sometimes they expect you as an individual, as an African-American, to speak for the whole entire African-American race. And as an individual, you know, it seems like a heavy responsibility to do because you're only one person and you don't share. You share a lot of the similar experiences, but you have your own to define. So sometimes that's an issue where they expect you to, as you know, you're educating them, they expect you to know everything and represent the African-American race as sharing that experience and perspective. And what I find out is once you're in there, you know, you've opened yourself up. But when everyone leaves, it's kind of like no one talks about it anymore. And it's like that's why we have to keep having these continued trainings, and you know, people ask why, and I find that that's an issue, that once you leave, it's kind of like you left everything back in the room and no one's talking about it anymore. They're just kind of going along their daily lives. So it's got to be a continuous thing of discussion, and that's pretty much it.
This is Peace Talks, and we're talking about peaceful race relations with Tanya Covington, Racial Justice Coordinator for the YWCA of the Middle Rio Grande, James Lewis, Chief Operating Officer of the City of Albuquerque, and Otiamba Umi, a student at the University of New Mexico. Who are some other inspiring figures in African American history, either in the past or maybe even today?
I think an awful lot about Fannie Lou Hamer, who really taught people about how to stand up. Septima Clark, who actually did the nonviolence training that Rosa Parks, that led Rosa Parks to her action of not giving up her seat on the bus. I think that there are a lot of people who this country would be so enriched if we knew their stories, if we knew their names. And there are people currently who are still doing that. I think about Bell Hooks and the wonderful academic writing that she does, people like that who are still, I feel like, forging the trail to this good day.
We did mention Martin Luther King Jr. with his nonviolent tactics. I also think of as almost not a counter, but kind of working with a Malcolm X by any means necessary. I think you need both those elements. And, you know, you have nonviolent, but you also have to have, you know, another aspect to kind of forge it. So Malcolm X, I really look up to.
Along with that, I just want to mention that, you know, in the 60s, you had the emanation of the Black Power movement, Stokely Carmichael, and he talked about economic power, social power. It was very misunderstood on what he was talking about. And as we look at people like Operation Push, Jesse Jackson today, he's still one of the forebearers that fought this fight. You got John Lewis, who's in Congress now, who walked side by side in Georgia. So we have a lot of folks out there that have paid their dues, and I'm hoping that our young folks can understand that we just got the right to vote in the early 1960s, 1964. Civil Rights Act, 1965, Voting Rights Act, 1968, Housing Rights Act. Why do we need acts to give us a right,
right,
if everything was okay?
You think about that, it didn't happen that long ago. So.
That's right.
Yeah.
So are y'all hopeful or hopeless about race relations?
Well, I'm a very optimistic person. I'm a very positive person, so I'm very hopeful. Either we're going to have to get along, or, you know, we will perish like fools.
What needs to change?
Well, I think we have to continue to work at it. It's not going to be easy, but I think that there has been some inroads made. As we look at the employment, there were sector jobs that, you know, we were chair porters. We did a lot of maintenance, but there are some, a lot of other opportunities that have opened up to us. So, but they got to continue to open up, and we got to continue to work at it. So I just feel very hopeful that this type of dialogue that we're having right here, that as people listen in, that they will become more educated, that they understand that Black history is just not one month. It is every day. We live it. They have to understand it. We have to understand our neighbors if you're not African American. So we have to learn to live together, and I think that's what it's all about.
Well, Tiamba, are you hopeful or hopeless?
I'm very hopeful. I think things have gotten a lot better as far as since slavery, you could say. We're no longer in shackles and chains, and I think things are looking hopeful. I've heard other opinions. People think that race relations are getting worse. But personally, I believe that things are getting better as long as we continue to have this awareness of race relations. And it's hard to get past, you know, just skin color and stereotypes. And you know, that's why we continue to have these issues and whatnot. But you have to realize that, you know, we are all humans. We are the human race. And that we all, you know, have love for each other and respect each other. And we need to continue doing that.
And what would you like to see fellow students or professors doing differently tomorrow?
I like this comment on attitude. If you go in with a mental attitude, you know, with, you know, straight from the heart, having respect for others and showing that love and compassion, that And just changing their attitudes about how we perceive things and just go around our daily lives and just kind of think about it in your head about what's going on. So,
Tanya Covington, hopeful or hopeless?
I'm always very hopeful, mainly because I feel like we live in a country where people have proven that they will change anything that they decide needs to be changed. And I'm hopeful that people look at race relations in this country and know that there needs to be a change. I think that individually all it would take is if tomorrow everyone decides that they're going to begin to be conscious of prejudice everywhere it is and not participate in it. And I think that can be done.
And what would that look like if I'm not participating?
If you're conscious of it, then you begin to see the things that are going on. You begin to see the kind of white privilege that you have. You speak up when you see injustice. There's a very old saying that says, "Evil persists when good men do nothing." I think all we have to do is decide that we're going to all be the good people who do something.
We're coming to the end of our program, and I want to ask each of you to briefly recommend any resources, if you know of books, websites, videos, that our listeners might refer to for more insight on this topic. Tanya?
There are a number of sources out there. I have to say that I'm a little hesitant to recommend any because what I think is most valuable is having the dialogue, people actually sitting down and talking to each other, finding out what their values are, finding out what each believes, and finding out about each other's life experiences. I feel like nothing is more valuable than that, and I would encourage people to find some way to enter into an honest and open dialogue about race.
One guy I really like to read is Dr. Cornel West. And he has a few books out on racism. I would recommend kind of touching up on him. But I really like that book. So.
Well, you know, and I think that there's a couple of experiences that you can have. I would recommend that you go and get the African-American experience and attend some of the African-American churches so you can get that feeling, get a chance to know some people. I would also suggest that we go to our libraries, the public library, University of New Mexico. I think you ought to go with the African American Studies program and see they got a whole archives. One of the books that I like on New Mexico history to a certain extent was Barbara Richardson, who is deceased today. She went around this state and got a lot of oral history and actually wrote a book. So there's a lot of resources out there, and so I don't think that there's a lack of.
Thank you. We'll list those as well as other materials and some links and excerpts from this program on our website, which is peacetalksradio.com. That's peacetalksradio, written as one word, .com. You can send us your feedback on our shows through that site. And if you're interested in possibly appearing on a future Peace Talks show as part of our studio audience, please send us an email from our website. There's also information there about how to get CD copies of our shows. Again, it's peacetalksradio.com. I'd like to thank Tanya Covington, Racial Justice Coordinator for the YWCA of the Middle Rio Grande, James Lewis, Chief Operating Officer of the City of Albuquerque, and Otiamba Umi, a student at the University of New Mexico, for being our guests on the program today.
Thank you.
I'd like to thank you for having us, and I think this is a program worth having, and I hope you continue to have it for a long period of time.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Peace Talks is a production of Good Radio Shows, Incorporated, and was recorded in the studios of KUNM in Albuquerque. Producer and engineer is Paul Ingalls. Music by Marvin Gaye and Ali Adelman. I'm Suzanne Kreider. Thanks for listening.